Case number 19-5131, Jasper Pelini versus Scott Jordan. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Arnold for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning. And may it please the court, Mr. Shackelford. My name is Tim Arnold. I am the attorney for Jasper Pelini. I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
We are here today because Mr. Pelini's direct appeal counsel failed to raise two critical and important issues in his case. His co-defendant's counsel raised those issues or closely related issues and obtained an orders either granting relief or strongly implying that relief would be granted. whereas Mr. Pelini's counsel raised a number of issues that were fairly weak, the weakest of which was an unpreserved argument that would have required the Supreme Court of Kentucky to overrule an opinion that had become final a month before the brief was filed. The first issue that I wanted to talk about is the claim that Mr. Pelini was deprived of his right to participate in a response to a jury question. This is the was referred to as the ex parte jury issue or the RCR 9.74 issue. in this case, the Kentucky Supreme Court rejected his claim on the basis of the harmless error standard that existed at the time they were reviewing it in 2014. And that standard was different than what would have existed in 2005 when the case was originally decided. And we know that because the harmless error standard they used was the Kodiakos standard, and Kentucky did not use that standard in any case prior to 2009. So clearly the standard had changed. and the court nevertheless decided that because the standard in 2014, he would have been harmless under that extraordinarily high burden that he had. It was therefore there was no prejudice to the claim. That's inconsistent with Strickland v. Washington and Smith v. Robbins, both of which speak in terms of whether the result of the proceeding or the result of the appeal would be different. The district court denied relief, finding that in determining whether prejudice occurred, the reviewing court should apply current governing law rather than the law in place at the time of the alleged deficiency, citing Lockhart versus Fretwell.
What's the best Supreme Court holding?
Pardon me?
What's the best Supreme Court holding in your favor? It wouldn't be Strickland necessarily. And what's the case that would address this circumstance, this change in circumstance, and say the court had to apply the prior law as opposed to the current law?
So Smith v. Robbins says that it adopts Strickland's standard. And says that the standard for determining appellate IAC is the same as Strickland, and that is whether the result of the appeal would be different. And I think that that is clearly referencing the result of the proceeding that he was in would be different, which is the appeal.
Was that a case, though, where there was a change in the interpretation of the law such that there was a difference in the interpretation of the law at the time of the appeal versus later at habeas?
I think that in Smith, the issue was a little bit different than this. You know, this is not a situation, you know, in this situation, you know, what has changed is not the law, the underlying objection. What has changed is just the standard of harmless error. Smith did not specifically address that, I don't
believe. And it's just a change in the interpretation of the law, isn't it?
In my case or in Smith? In this case, it is a change in the interpretation of the harmless error standard. It is not a change in the interpretation.
The law hasn't changed, though. It's just the interpretation has changed.
The law itself has not changed. The harmless error standard has changed, although it has changed back. Recently the Supreme Court found it to be a structural error in the case that we cited in our reply brief that's now final, Ebersole. But Fretwell does not deal with changes to the harmless error standard. Fretwell was, the question in that case was that the issue that he was seeking relief on was something that he was never entitled to in the first place. It was what Justice O'Connor described as a wholly meritless objection. And in this case, my client is entitled to, this is an error today. This was an error in 2005. This would have been an error in 1944. There's no doubt that the objection had merit. Nobody has argued that the objection lacked merit. The issue that has been raised is whether or not, in spite of the error, he shouldn't get relief because of the harmless error standard. That's the only change that has happened. And so our position would be that Lockhart v. Fairwell does not deal with that, doesn't propose to deal with that. And that the Supreme Court in Williams v. Taylor made that fairly clear. Like, you know, in that case, Virginia court had attempted something fairly similar, and the United States Supreme Court rejected that the argument that Lockhart had changed the prejudice standard and cited to Justice O'Connor's concurring opinion in explaining why Lockhart really didn't do that. That this
I go
was
back to your textual point. Lockhart, in my mind, is the case that's most analogous to our case. But the textual point you made about the relief that could have been granted at the time, I think, was a point Justice Stevens raised in dissent in Lockhart. And the majority, I think expressly makes the point you're making now, but the majority didn't buy it.
That may be the, I think that Justice O'Connor's opinion is, the one that I think the court, Justice Stevens, in his opinion in Williams v. Taylor, sort of points to Justice O'Connor's opinion as being
The point that in Lockhart itself, Justice Stevens made the point you're making, which the Strickland standard is could have prevailed at the time, and so you're trying to lock in the law at the time, but the majority didn't adopt that position in Lockhart. So it feels like maybe silently, maybe verbally, but they're arguably the Supreme Court majority rejected the textual point you're making right now.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. The issue in in that particular case, the claim he was making is I could have gotten relief if only I had raised it at the right time, because this window of opportunity existed where the law was in my favor. And what had happened to him is that the law had changed to clarify that the statute he was seeking to declare unconstitutional was not unconstitutional. He had not been deprived of anything he was entitled to. My client was clearly deprived of something he was entitled to. Nobody is disputing that. and so having that, it was a significant deprivation for him because of the deprivation. We simply do not know if the jury understood critical evidence in the case. They clearly had questions about it.
Let me ask you, I have a question. How do you distinguish the Sixth Circuit case of Abbey versus Howe, 2014, where it said that an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim fails where, quote, any objection by counsel would have been wholly meritless under current governing law, even if the objection might have been considered meritorious at the time of its omission?
Yeah, again, I think that where the difference is and the distinction I'm trying to draw, and perhaps not as clearly as I should, is between whether the objection has merit is a substantive question of whether you were entitled to something. The harmless error standard is not about whether the objection has merit. A meritorious objection that is nevertheless harmless is still a meritorious objection. The question, the harmless error standard is simply an effort to determine whether or not, in spite of the error, the result, the proceeding can still be affirmed. So that is the difference that I'm drawing, is that in this particular case, we are not dealing with a meritless objection. So Abbey versus Howe is dealing with an objection where the law had changed back to unfavorably to the defendant, and he is, and I think it was a he, was, wishing to get the benefit of the prior law. And in this particular case, my client is not seeking to get my client doesn't have to go back to prior law to respect to his objection. He's simply saying that the issue should be evaluated under the harmless error standards that prevailed at the time, because that is not about whether he has a right to.
I understand your point. Maybe that's valid. All right. We're under AEDPA, though, aren't we? You've got a high burden here of showing not just that the Kentucky Supreme Court was wrong, but that its decision was unreasonable. Now, what U.S. Supreme Court case do you have that would be closest to saying what happened here was so unreasonable that we should reverse?
I believe that, I think in Strickland, in Smith versus Robbins, I think that they were clear that it was the result at the time. I don't think, in terms of, first, I want to be clear, the Kentucky Supreme Court did not consider this. This wasn't their interpretation of Lockhart versus Fretwell. They never discussed Lockhart versus Fretwell.
They don't have to, do they?
What's that?
They don't have to. They don't have to cite. They don't have, as long as they get the law right, they don't have to.
I think that's probably fair. I think that my point is simply that this wasn't a situation where we're deferring to a state court's decision on a point. This was raised sort of after the fact. I don't believe Lockhart versus Fretwell has anything to do with this case, as I said. I think Smith versus Robbins makes clear that the provision is for the error is, whether or not the result of the proceeding would be different, and the result of the proceeding we contend would have been different had this error not occurred. Or, and so had this, had Mr. Pelini's counsel raised the error at the time. And so, you know, that's ultimately where we're at. I want to spend, I have only a couple minutes left, so I wanted to turn to the second issue, which was the burglary continuation argument. And I want to be clear that, you know, there is no, there was at the time my client's petition was filed, no state process to raise ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, because the Kentucky Supreme Court had ruled that rule that RCR 1142, which is the state post-conviction relief rule, did not allow for you to raise ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failing to raise an individual claim. And they had created no other procedure. And so they described it as not cognizable in this jurisdiction. And this court in Boykin versus Webb said the same thing, that there was no procedure available, and so there was nothing to exhaust. So I think that regardless of how this case came about, my client was never under an obligation to raise this claim in state court. And that's the basis. So
one interesting aspect of that argument is that the state court of appeals believed him to be arguing ineffective assistance of appellate counsel.
And so, yeah, I wanted to turn to that. So this is a situation where I think the Commonwealth was hoisted on its own petard, because the first mention of appellate deficient performance was by the Attorney General in their brief, responding to Pelini's brief, denying, in the initial appeal, denying post-conviction review. That is the first time that anybody used the phrase appellate counsel was deficient. And they were responding to an argument that was titled trial counsel was deficient. And so what happened there was that the Attorney General was trying to move this case into an area they knew relief would not be granted because it was not cognizable. And they got the ruling they wanted. The Kentucky Court of Appeals said it's not cognizable. Mr. Pelini, pro se, raises this issue as part of his MDR, and the Commonwealth fails to point out that it wasn't properly raised. The Supreme Court remands it for Holland, and from that point on, they're just like, well, we decided we were going to remand it, and your opportunity to object to that is lost. So this was not a situation. Mr. Pelini's initial post-conviction pleading does not say appellate counsel was ineffective. It doesn't say trial counsel either. It says counsel. But the ineffectiveness that's alleged is clearly directed towards trial counsel, because it says that because of counsel's failure to act, the issue could not be raised on appeal. And so I think it was intended to be that. I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Mr. Shackelford.
May it please the court, Mr. Arnold. I don't think it hurts to keep in mind that there's overwhelming evidence that Mr. Pelini shot and killed Byron Pruitt. He even requested a self-defense instruction. Jury didn't buy it. They convicted him of wanton murder for firing that shot. Now, regarding the first issue, first of all, we disagree. We have disagreed all along that the state courts did not apply harmless error in looking at a violation of the state rule of procedure, which is what is at issue here. The district court, for example, cited the Garland versus Commonwealth case back in 2003, which was 2 years before the decision of the Supreme Court in Mr. Pelini's case. Now, when it came back to the Kentucky Supreme Court, they said, look, we don't have to decide whether or not what our standard was back then. We can apply what the standard is now. They cited two Fifth Circuit cases, and it's, even though they didn't cite the Lockhart versus Fretwell case, it's consistent entirely with Lockhart. Now, Mr. Arnold has suggested that the standard has gone into flux again, and he's referring to the Eversole case that he cited in his reply brief. That is now final. Eversole, however, doesn't even mention State Rule 9.74. Instead, it talks about a juror had been offered a bribe, reported to the court never informed the parties, never informed the attorneys, so there was no chance for the defendant to determine whether or not the bribe offer affected his fundamental fairness to an impartial jury. So that's what Eversole is about. Eversole is really irrelevant here.
Well, your friend on their side, and he made the argument much better than I will, but he distinguished between other cases and this case where the legal right never changed. In other words, the legal error, the basis for the legal error never changed. All that's changed here is the relief, perhaps, that a court should grant or how a court should judge the legal error, as opposed to other cases where maybe the legal error wasn't even in existence and legal law changed the fact that there was even a basis for error to begin with. I'm not sure I didn't articulate as well as your friend on the other side, but did you pick up on that point and do you have a response to that?
Well, what Lockhart says is, look, that you can change it as long as it doesn't, there's no fundamental unfairness to that. And the Kentucky Supreme Court looked at that very issue in Pelini 5. It said, look, nobody governs their conduct based upon a standard of review by an appellate court. So that Mr. Pelini did, his conduct was not affected. He didn't rely on it in any way. And so, therefore, it's not unfair to apply that retroactively if, in fact, we've changed. Now, again, our position all along and what the district court found was that the Kentucky courts had applied tested for harmlessness. The Mr. Pelini's argument up through in state court, now in district court, up to today has been, look, this was a type of structural error under state law, violation of 9.74, and so that it's automatic reversal on appeal. But we've documented in our brief and the district court found that they did, in fact, review for error in all of these cases since about 1940. I think the earliest case I found, the Garland case, refers to, going back to 1970 at least, where the state courts had started getting away from a strict interpretation. So the other thing is that when we look at whether or not there is prejudice, the test isn't simply a but-for test in this kind of situation. Strickland recognized that what you're really looking at is whether or not something is fundamentally unfair. It then applied the typical two-pronged test for most cases. However, again, Lockhart says, look, in some cases, that's not sufficient. We have to look at whether or not the result is fundamentally unfair. And if we ignore that, it's a defective application of Strickland. That's what Lockhart says. And so one of the cases, and that was one of them, because yes, he would have, the prisoners would have prevailed originally, but since the law changed, we can apply it retroactively. And if we don't, they will have gotten a windfall because of the change in the law under that circumstances. And then even more clear is the Weaver versus Massachusetts case that came out in 2017. And that was what we call a structural error. Part of the courtroom had been closed through the trial, part of the trial. And so the claim was that's structural error, that's automatic reversal. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not. This is one of the rare cases where you look to see what impact did this have on the results of the trial? And there was no impact. Here, the impact on the trial was zero, because all along, Mr. Pelini's counsel had argued this tape should be the only thing admitted. The transcripts are not as good evidence. He objected four times for the admission of these tapes. When the jury sent out the note saying, look, you know, we're having trouble locating the tape. Can we get a copy of the transcript? And the trial judge responded, there's none available. Should have called in the attorneys. He didn't. But the answer still would have been the same. The Kentucky Supreme Court said that if he had sent that back, because it had not been admitted into evidence, it would be reversible error. And so
I'd be curious to hear. I don't want to cut off my colleagues, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about the procedural default issue.
On the 974 or the,
yeah, I don't want, if my colleagues had questions on the other issue, I don't want to get you off track, but I did want to hear your thoughts on why when procedural default is an important rule, and there are many reasons why we require individuals to raise issues with the state court before we're going to review them on habeas. But here, the law at the time didn't even recognize an argument about ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. So how are we supposed to default someone for not raising an argument that the state didn't even recognize?
Well, okay, yes, and thank you. You've switched off to the next point.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't want you to lose all your time on the first one. But.
No, thank you. Well, I think that a couple of things. First of all, under the line of cases with the Engle case, and then later Bowsley, the U.S. Supreme Court says, look, just because a state has not recognized something in the past doesn't mean they're not going to recognize and change their opinions. And when the state courts initially looked at ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, they looked at it very narrowly. They said, only if you have an omitted brief entirely. We're not going to review claims, or we're not going to recognize that under a strict reading of U.S. Supreme Court law, that omitted issues is ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. They changed that in the Holland case. But there is nothing that prevented him from filing in his 1142 a motion as one of his claims that counsel was ineffective. And as the first issue indicates, the state courts were in fact receptive to his claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. So that's kind of the pink elephant. The other thing that Mr. Arnold has
I always thought it was white elephant, but pink one would be interesting too. But I thought the rule was that if there's some indication that a court might change the law, you know, there's been some writing or there's a petition pending with a court, that sometimes you say a party's on notice, they probably should have raised an argument because there was some sort of commentary out there or dissenting opinions or other things that might suggest a change in law. So you want to make sure you preserve it. But is there anything here suggesting that the state Supreme Court would fundamentally change the law to recognize a claim it had thus far? And it's not just like a substantive claim, but it's also just, there's some procedural aspects to it as well. And that you just don't even bring this line of argument that appellate counsel is ineffective. Is there anything out there to suggest the court was going to do this?
Well, there's nothing that we briefed. I can say that I do know that there is some case law that really dealt with ineffective assistance of appointed counsel in filing certain pleadings. So there was some movement, but I can't say that there was anything casting a giant shadow or a ray of sunlight from the state jurisprudence. But I don't think that that's required. I don't think that's what Engle says. I don't think that's what Bowsley says. I think that what, respectfully, Judge Riedler, what you're probably referring to is if counsel doesn't anticipate a change in law, is counsel ineffective? I think that's correct, but that's different than not raising it and then being procedurally defaulted because you didn't raise it. And especially since the overwhelming majority of other states recognize ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for a
minute. Why is it different? I thought it seems to me like the same thing.
Well, because you're talking about, is counsel ineffective for not raising a claim that they could see was coming? Most of the time, they're not ineffective for anticipating a change of law. However, if it's pretty clear that the law is moving this way, sometimes they're obligated to raise that claim. Right. But that's in a different setting. That's whether counsel was ineffective for not raising it. Here, counsel, it's not a question of ineffective assistance. Counsel is, did you, under principles of federalism, give a state a chance to change their mind? And again, in this case, even though there was nothing specifically that I can point to in state jurisprudence, the overwhelming number of states, if not all of them, already recognized this. So that they certainly had an obligation to raise it. And in addition, again, I don't think this is the case when you look at what was done. If you get to the cause here, or excuse me, the prejudice on this second claim, there is no prejudice. The burglary statute as an element says, look, if somebody is armed with a deadly weapon during the entry during the burglary or in the immediate flight of the burglary, that raises it to the first degree, greater enhancement. The jury was instructed on that on the first degree burglary of Mr. Ziegler's garage. At that point, the Supreme Court said, look, there is sufficient evidence that he was armed while he was inside Mr. Ziegler's garage. The Supreme Court rejected the claim otherwise. And so this court, I think, is bound by that there was sufficient evidence to say he was armed while he was inside Mr. Ziegler's garage. And there's no evidence, no hint that he left the gun inside the garage. So that instruction was, because there's sufficient evidence to support the conviction, that means there was sufficient evidence to support the instruction. And therefore, there's no prejudice. There's no prejudice by trial counsel for failing to object to it because it would have been meritless, and certainly no merit to the claim that appellate counsel should have raised it as a what we call palpable error, what you all call plain error on appeal. So there is no, even if there were cause, there's no prejudice on that second issue.
Well, excuse me, wasn't his sister Plank, the conviction was reversed because the Kentucky Supreme Court held that he wasn't in the process of committing a burglary at the time he shot the gun.
Yes, what happened, and thank you, Judge Gilliam, what happened is he robbed Mr. Ziegler's garage. He came back with his sister to retrieve a toolbox.
Right.
Okay. Well, his sister was not involved during the burglary itself. She was at home, so that her participation was not during the burglary part. So that's the confusion. On direct appeal, the Supreme Court said, look, you can't use the burglary as an enhancement on the murder sentence. And so we're going to send it back for a new sentencing phase. He got a new sentencing phase. But during the guilt phase murder charge, there was no mention of, on that instruction, of the burglary or whether or not there was immediate flight from that garage. So therefore, I don't think that there's any prejudice whatsoever. And I see my time is about up.
Can I take you back to cause for a minute? Our decision in Matthews versus Parker, does that control the outcome here? And if not, why not?
Well, I don't, for two reasons. First of all, they did not talk about futility, so they didn't even get into that doctrine. And then the second thing is it's inconsistent with Supreme Court opinion. And there's a 2010 decision from this court. I haven't cited it. It's called Lucido, L-U-C-I-D-O, that says, look, a panel can overrule an earlier panel decision of a published case if it's inconsistent with U.S. Supreme Court law. And my response is that case is inconsistent with Supreme Court law if it's not distinguishable from this case.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shackelford. Mr. Arnold, do you have rebuttal? You need to put your...
Sorry, my apologies. this is now an officially a Zoom meeting. The, looking at the second issue and working backwards, in the issue of sort of what the default is that the rule itself didn't exist. It is not a situation where the Supreme Court viewed ineffective assistance of appellate counsel unfavorably, and so people just didn't choose to raise it because they didn't think that they could win it. It was that there was no rule by which to raise it. And we know that because the Holland Court felt it had to change Rule 1142 in the opinion in order to allow the claim to proceed. So there was no rule by which it could be raised. And that makes it very different than the Engle case, where the rule was always there. It was just a matter of, we don't think the Supreme Court of Ohio is going to grant relief on this issue. This was not a question of whether they thought the court might be interested in the claim. This was, there was no vehicle by which to raise the claim. Secondly, with respect to the second issue, the prejudice here, I think, is, as Judge Gilman pointed out, the co-defendant received obtained relief on this very related claim. And the basis of it was because he was not. What happened is the jury was, you know, informed by the Commonwealth, and it was an argument. The court had decided before trial that it was an issue of fact whether he was an immediate flight from the Ziegler burglary at the time of the Pruitt shooting. And, you know, the Commonwealth argued explicitly that they should believe that he was in immediate flight from the Ziegler burglary, and that he should, you know, as a result of that, you could find both Plank and Pelini guilty of murder on that basis alone without getting into intent. You know, the Commonwealth's contention is that he was found guilty of wanton murder. We don't know what murder he was found guilty of. The jury instructions are both intentional and wanton, and the jury just found him guilty of murder. The Commonwealth's argument was that he was intentional, but even if intentional murder was not established, you know, he would have been guilty of wanton murder because he was still in flight from the burglary. This was, you know, the court subsequently found that he was, as a matter of law, not in flight from the burglary, and so all of those arguments were no longer valid. And so the court was seriously misinformed about the law that they would be using to decide this issue. And that was significant because Pelini's, you know, the statements from both Pelini and Plank were that Pelini was not aiming at Mr. Pruitt. He was trying to scare him off. The medical examiner's testimony was that the path of the bullet was consistent with the bullet descending. And so, you know, there was an argument to be made that he had not, that this was an accidental shooting as opposed to an intentional one. And that would raise the question of what level of wantonness or recklessness was provided for, which would have resulted in a lesser conviction for Mr. Pelini. So that's why that is an issue. In terms of the first issue, brief time I have left, if I could distinguish, Weaver is a very narrow case. It says specifically it is limited to, public denial of a public trial, a jury selection. And the issue that in that case, because there was no way to establish there was a denial, that a different result due to the denial of a public trial, it was the defendant's argument that if he could establish a denial of fundamental fairness, he still was entitled to something. The Supreme Court did not embrace that was in fact the rule. It simply said that he couldn't establish the fundamental fairness, and therefore that was that. What it principally wanted to be clear about was that in a case of structural error, it's still, if it's a Strickland claim, you still have to prove Strickland prejudice. It's not enough to say it was a structural error. And so in this particular case, we believe it was a structural error, but even if it was under a harmless error standard, the harmless error standard it would have been under would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a much lesser standard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the case under submission.